transfiguration of Jesus really stands out in the Gospel of Mark. Because of all the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Mark tends to be the most grounded, the most down to earth. He doesn't often digress into long sections of Jesus' teachings, for example. But there is an immediacy to the actions and the interactions of Jesus with his disciples, with his opponents, with the crowds who surround him, which is what sets this otherworldly, visionary experience of the Transfiguration set atop a high mountain on the very outskirts of heaven, to use Robert Gundry's words, with only Peter and James and John. It's what sets this apart from the rest of the gospel. It's an event shrouded in mystery. Even the disciples don't understand it. And yet, together with the passage that we explored last week, in which Peter first recognizes that Jesus is the Messiah, and Jesus, for the first time, predicts both his death and his resurrection, these two passages are intimately connected. The Transfiguration marks the center and the turning point of the story that Mark tells, where Jesus is once again affirmed, as he was at the beginning of the gospel at his baptism, and as he will be again at the end on the cross. He's affirmed as the Son of God. But it's on the disciples' experience of the Transfiguration that I want to focus our attention this morning. Peter, James, and John, the three whom Jesus has singled out to accompany him up to the top of the mountain. For them, the Transfiguration is a confusing, a disorienting experience. Mark has excelled at highlighting the disciples' confusion and failure to comprehend throughout the gospel. They say that it's from Peter's memoirs that Mark wrote his story. And if so, Peter is not afraid to admit how often he did not understand. Never more so than in this preceding passage when Jesus first predicts his death, and Peter rejects that as absolutely impossible. The disciples couldn't comprehend how the Messiah and the cross could coexist, how the Christ could suffer and die. This simply did not compute in their understanding. There was no place for this new information within the existing constructs of everything they thought they knew about Jesus and about God. And 6 days later, Mark tells us, the disciples take this sense of confusion and disorientation with them up the mountain. And so from the perspective of Peter and James and John, the Transfiguration has sort of a dreamlike quality to it. Sort of the way our minds try and make sense of things while we sleep. There's bizarre imagery and an unusual combination of characters. The scene is shifting again and again, and a voice comes from heaven. No wonder these three are confused. When Peter finally manages to spit out something about putting up three shelters for Jesus and Moses and Elijah, Mark tells us he didn't know what to say. He was so frightened. They're quite literally enveloped in a cloud, and they can hardly see which way is up and which way is down. And then just as suddenly the cloud is gone and the vision is over and they find themselves once again alone with Jesus. They head back down the mountain as confused as ever, discussing amongst themselves what Jesus could possibly mean by rising from the dead. It's curious how it's Moses and Elijah who appear with Jesus atop the mountain. They've been said to represent the law and the prophets, the two greatest figures of the Old Testament, or the so-called deathless ones, who according to Jewish tradition were those who were taken alive into heaven and whose return was promised before the end of the age. But it's interesting to me that both Moses and Elijah also had significant mountaintop experiences in the midst of times of uncertainty and confusion. In the wake of Israel's rebellion with the golden calf, when it appeared that God might just abandon his people, Moses begged for assurance that God would continue to go with them up to the promised land. "Show me your glory," Moses had begged God. That's when the Lord set him in the cleft of the rock atop Mount Sinai and covered him with his hand, passing by in the cloud and proclaiming his name, that he was a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. Centuries later, Elijah would stand atop the same mountain, having fled from the wrath of Ahab and Jezebel, having given everything that he could, but accounting himself a failure. He'd witnessed the power of the wind and the earthquake and the fire, only to experience God in the still, small voice, reorienting him, recommissioning him, and sending him back out for the work that he still had to do. Moses and Elijah both came to their mountain disoriented and confused, much like the disciples with Jesus. But they left refreshed and reoriented and transformed because they'd experienced God there. The disciples, like Moses, like Elijah, hear a voice from the midst of the cloud. At the center of their disorientation and confusion, God speaks and says, "This is my Son, whom I love. Listen to him." When the disciples were confused and what they thought they knew turns out to be wrong, or at least inadequate and incomplete, the voice of God directs their attention back to Jesus, shining like a beacon atop the mountain. He is their reference point in the midst of the cloud and the swirling darkness. Now, I think it's crucial to understand that listening to Jesus and following him down from the mountain did not result in a return to what was comfortable or familiar, to what the disciples thought they knew about life and faith and Jesus. No, instead, their disorientation had to give way to a reorientation, which is to say a transformation of themselves and their understanding, a process that continues through the rest of the gospel. There is no going back. For them, this has been a necessary confusion. In the next couple of weeks, we're going to be marking 1 year since COVID turned our world upside down. It's upended so much that we took for granted. It's been confusing. It's been disorienting. It's been painful and frustrating. For nearly a year, we have been living in the midst of this cloud of uncertainty and confusion. And there's still a lot we don't know about what the world is going to look like when the cloud lifts. In the meantime, many of us have been in the midst of our own clouds of grief and doubt and uncertainty over this past year. But in the midst of the cloud, a voice calls out, pointing us back to Jesus. "This is my Son, whom I love. Listen to him." What does it mean to listen to and continue to trust Jesus in the midst of the dark clouds of this season of uncertainty, in the midst of times of confusion and disorientation that are a normal and necessary part of the life of faith? We want to fix it. We want to control it. Like Peter, we want to plan our way out of it. But these are times that call most of all for listening and trusting and waiting, of a reorientation back to the Jesus who shines brightly before us. "This is my Son, listen to him. It's as the disciples make their way down the mountain that Mark seems to assure us that there are just some things that we're not going to be able to process and understand right now. Jesus tells Peter and James and John not to talk about what they've seen, not until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. In another place, he tells them, I have more to say to you than you can now bear. And so we're left with faith, seeking understanding. As we turn our eyes upon Jesus and follow him one step at a time. But one thing's for certain, he won't lead us back the same way we came. I want to give you a couple of questions to think and pray through as Sandy comes and plays in a moment. And the first is, in what ways do you find yourself in the midst of the cloud today? Where are you disoriented or confused, uncertain or doubtful? And second, where do you see Jesus with you in the midst of the cloud? How is he inviting you to listen to and continue to trust him in the midst of this experience? Where do you see him shining brightly? Let's spend a little time with those questions as Sandy plays.